Roger Sally.
Oh, eight.
Good evening, all. My name is Keith. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Keith.
It's an absolute pleasure to be with you guys tonight. I know a lot of people in this room. I really do. I've been here for almost a year and a half now. And I've met an awful lot of you, and you mean a lot to me. I am an alcoholic. We're going to talk about what that means, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I had a real good run of sober living, and then I turned 13. And that day is very, very vivid in my mind. I can tell you what the color of the room was. I can tell you what the temperature outside was. I remember it very, very vividly. We were living over in Edmonds. I, at that time, was living with my grandparents, who had taken to raising me since I was seven. My dad had left us. He was an alcoholic, and he had left when I was five, and then came back and left again when I was six. And I was pissed, and he was gone. My mom was the dearest, loveliest lady ever, but she was mentally ill. And most of her time was spent up at Northern State in Cedar Woolley. So my grandparents pitched in and they were raising me. They were wonderful people, absolutely wonderful people. And they did not drink. There was a little bit of drinking at Christmas time, and that's what I drank that night. It was an afternoon that I started. They rarely ever left. We were very home people. And they rarely ever left, and I was 13, and they left, and I found the Four Roses whiskey. This was the bottle that was tucked away in the linen cabinet that was brought out at Christmas time to make Tom and Jerry's. Well, I didn't make Tom and Jerry's. I just did it the Western way. I took the cap off and took a big old hit on that, and magic occurred. Absolute magic. It just exploded in me. Absolutely exploded, and it just went down, and it was warm, and then it was too warm, and then it was almost came back out, and it just moved through me. It moved through me, and something profound happened. I wanted another, and I wanted another right now. I was going to pace myself and just have one or two and just taste it, because I wanted to know what this was all about. I'd heard a little bit, and I wanted to know what it was all about. And I wanted another right away. And I remember I took another right away. Right away. And that started 25 years of wanting another. 25 years of wanting another. And I had another. And then I don't know how many more I had, but a bunch more. Because the rest of the things that happened to me many, many times happened right there. I eventually blacked out, because I don't remember. I upchucked, and then I passed out. And then something profound happened beyond all of that that was wonderful and that changed the way that I drank pretty much. I got away with it. I got away with it. My grandparents came home, and I lied through my teeth and said it must have been something that I ate. My grandmother was raised in the Depression, and she rarely threw any food away. So in our kitchen, there was frequently food that might be a little past its good time. And every once in a while, we would eat that, and we would all become ill. And it's just being Depression people, that's what they, you know, that's the way she was raised, and that's the way it was. Well, I blamed it all on that, and I built it up real well, and I just had one good lie going, and I got away with it, and they didn't know. Now, how they didn't know, I'm not sure. These were not stupid people, because I smelled like I had been drinking, I looked like I had been drinking, and I was hungover the next day. I remember. You know, because I had to, that happened on a Friday, and Saturday we had our own business, and I had to wash the backhoe the next day. And it was a bitch, because I didn't feel good. And I snuck back into the house and I had another hit. And that started a cycle. That if you don't feel good, take another one. Take another one. Take another one. And I did that a lot. Anyway, that went on for a long, long time. I drank my way through high school and I went on and went to college, went to Bellingham, met my lovely wife, married her. She's still with me. I have no idea why she stayed, because I kept drinking. And I got through school. I was kind of periodic, but not really. I did a lot of maintenance drinking, and then I would get completely, totally blasted spring break, winter break, all the breaks. And it was kind of a cycle where you had midterms and you could get a couple days off, so I could get really, really good and drunk. There was always a drunk coming. It was always anticipation. I could get through time by waiting to the next one because I knew it was coming, but it would build in me. It would build and build. There was this restless, irritable, discontent feeling, and it was just. And then there was also the part of doing well on finals and rewarding yourself. I did well. I got A's. Let's get drunk. And the real reason was is I was an alcoholic and I just wanted to get drunk. Okay? That's what it was all about. I'm not going to spend a whole bunch of time on that. I'm going to jump way forward. That was... I started drinking, like I said, when I was, I'm going to go all the way till I was 37 years old. In the fall of 90, 10 months later, I would be sober. But this is, I'm going to give you this one episode, and it kind of explains what I'm talking about. I became an archaeologist. Now I got a master's degree. Absolutely love what I do. I love what I do. But I had pretty well worked, by the time I was 37, I had pretty much worked through all the people that would hire me because I wasn't very dependable. At that point, they wouldn't let me have a project anymore because I failed to write them up. I would love to go out and do the work part and get the money, but then I wouldn't write them up. So I was pretty much unemployable, but I talked these people into giving me a job. And it was, we were just north of St. George on the freeway, and it was a two-day session. Two 10-day sessions with 4 days in between. It was a small crew, about 5 or 6 people. I was in charge. But we all got together and decided that we'd just work 20 days straight so that we could get done early and not have the 4 day off. And that started on day one and built with that anticipation of getting really good and drunk. Now, trust me, I was drinking every night after work, you know, half a dozen beers, a couple whiskeys. So just to keep the, you know, keep alcoholically, you know, pleased. You got to have a little. But I was anticipating the end of that work. And the crew started off liking me a little. By the time that 20-day period, I was a monster. I had just turned into a monster. I was prickly would not come close to what I was because I wanted to get drunk. And we weren't done, and they weren't working fast enough, because if they would have worked faster, we could have got out on day 18, you know, instead of day 20, and I just want to get done. So it's building, and it's building. And this anticipation, and I, you know, now I had borrowed my grandparents' travel trailer. They lived in Yuma by then, and I was living in this travel trailer, and day 20 finally came. And I was going to take it back and deliver it. They were going to put some winter visitors in it down in their place, and I had to get it to Yuma. But it went through Vegas to get there. It wasn't exactly a direct route, but it went through Vegas. So I headed to Vegas. Well, before I left St. George, I had to go across town with this 28-foot travel trailer to the liquor store. It's all state stores in Utah. And I knew where it was. I had it all scoped out. I was going to get me a bottle, and I was going to sit it in the seat beside me, and we were going to drive to Vegas, okay? And when we got to Vegas, we were going to party. Well, I don't even think I got to out to the Virgin Canyon before it called to me. Have one. Just one, you'll feel better. And I did. And by the time I got to Vegas, it was pretty much gone. And I was pretty much gone. And I'm pulling a travel trailer. And we're coming in, and there's a place you can go in downtown Vegas and stay free if you spend a little money in their casino. One of the other things, it's not part of the AA thing, but I was also a compulsive gambler. I've been doing that for quite a while, and that didn't please my wife either. And that was in anticipation too, because I don't know whether you know it, but you can gamble in Vegas. So I'm coming in, and I'm three sheets to the wind, drank most of that fifth, and apparently I was not as attentive as I could have been, and I blew through a red light. Well, there was a motorcycle coming the other way, and he thought green light meant go, and he didn't realize there was a travel trailer in his way. And apparently you can't stop those immediately, and sometimes when you do, they get all wobbly. Well, this got a little more than wobbly. He laid it down and slid right into the dual axles of that travel trailer.
Oh.
Yeah, and he was very hurt. And I'm kind of stopping and looking in the rear view mirror. And I don't really know how large this man was, but my image of him was he was about 7'4 and weighed 450 pounds. And he got up and limped towards me with road rash all the way down one side.
Oh.
And his leathers were all tore up, and there was fire in his eyes. Fire in his eyes. Now, I might be a drunken alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. And I quickly realized that the best for me was is to leave. So I just drove away. And the only thing I remember distinctly in the mirror is he was hobbling faster. And I drove away quicker. So I just quickly pulled away and hid my trailer in the parking lot where I had planned to go, and just hoped like hell that I would never be caught for leaving the scene of an accident with an incredibly angry man after me. And I went ahead and went into the casino, and I just had a hell of a good time. I mentioned I was a gambler, and I just started hitting it. Man, I just started hitting it. I had 1,000, and then pretty soon I had 1,500, and I was 2,000, and I wasn't feeling good. I couldn't get drunk. It wasn't coming. There was no relief. I had anticipated this for 20 days, and there was no relief. I was just a mess. I wasn't enjoying it. I was winning all this money, and it was like nothing. I was used to losing, and it wasn't until, you know, and I was just an absolute mess. So I drank some more, hoping that that would relieve that. Well, at some point, the usual happened, and apparently I blacked out. And I took a nap at the slot machine. And apparently, if you're not beating them fast enough, they just assume you move along. And they had called the local authorities. Well, I came out of the blackout, and there's an officer standing in front of me, and he's got my driver's license. He's holding on to my driver's license, and he's kind of gripping it and looking at it. Now, I don't know what possessed me to do this, but I reached out and grabbed it from him and staggered away. I'm not going to say I ran. I'm not going to say I fled fast. I just staggered away. Now, I think he was kind of fed up with drunks and just as soon be done with me. He did not pursue me with great... He could have caught me real quick if he would have got right after it. But he didn't. He sat there for a few minutes. I think he thought about it. But he also, I don't know how you are with police, they don't like it when you do that. So he got on his little radio and said, "We got a staggerer here." So I exited the building, and I hear, you know, I see police coming. You know, I think they're looking for me. Maybe it's a coincidence, they're looking for somebody else, but it seemed as if they were probably looking for me. So I did the only thing that seemed reasonable, is there was a trash can there, one of these big dumpsters, and I jumped in the dumpster. And I pulled the lid in. And I could see lights, blue lights flashing on the outside through the little lip of the thing, and it was all going well. I was just in there, and apparently I decided that maybe I should finish my nap. Well, okay, I passed out again. And I don't know how much time I spent in there or how long it was, but the next thing that I heard was beep, beep, beep. The truck is coming to dump the dumpster. It's 2 or 3 in the morning. Now, in case you ever want to see the expression of a driver look awfully shocked, when somebody flips open the lid and jumps out of the dumpster and walks past him as if you just got up and you're headed to work. Yep, this is the way we always do it where I come from. Yep, this is fine. And I just headed back to my trailer and I slept off that and I continued. And one more thing happened on that trip, other than just not getting, feeling good and not doing anything. I went on down to Laughlin once more. By the time I was done, I had over 4,000 in my pocket. And it meant nothing. I should have been ecstatic. I should have been joyful. It should have been one of the happiest times of my life because I never won anything like that. And it was just, I was just dead. It meant absolutely nothing. I couldn't get anything out of it. So I left Laughlin. I'm headed down. I have no idea what time it is. And I pull in to get diesel. No, it was a gas. It was a gas truck. I got diesels now. But I pulled in to get gas at a convenience store. And I don't know what I was thinking, and I thought it was odd. And you guys probably would know immediately that this wasn't what you do. But the liquor cabinet lights were off. And apparently that means that they will no longer sell it to you. I didn't know that. So I went and got me a quart of beer and went up and put it on the counter to buy it. And the clerk gave me a look. And it's a look that I remember incredibly well. It was complete and total disgust. You alcoholic little bastard. Why do you think you're going to get this? First of all, we don't sell past whatever time it was or whatever time it wasn't because it was in the middle of the morning. And it was just like, it was the look that it cuts you all the way down and you know that you really have, I mean, there was just no pity. It was just disgust. Just disgust. And my guessing is that they had an alcoholic in their life. And that they had a relative or a husband or a brother that had been where I was. Because you could look at my eyes and just tell that I was gone. I was gone. Anyway, I drank for a couple more months, early spring. My wife was leaving, and I was kind of semi-okay with that because she was holding me back. I don't know how I could have drank more, but I was wanting to because more was always what I wanted. And I called down to the local club. I got the number out of the white pages, and I called AA. And a fellow came up and spent an hour with me, and he 12-stepped me. He sat on my kitchen couch, and he told me what my problem was. I didn't know what I didn't know, and he started to tell me what I didn't know. And I started understanding the things that I didn't know. I have phenomenal craving, and I have obsession. Those are the two things that are prominent in me. Is that I have the obsession to drink when I get restless, irritable, and discontent, and I get the craving of alcohol when I get one in me, I gotta have more. And more never is enough. There is never enough. There is absolutely, I have never, ever had enough. Ever. I have thrown up and felt really gypped because I just lost the alcohol. Now that's a sick thought that only an alcoholic would have. The other thought was I need to start doing this in a bucket because I think there's a way we could get this again.
Oh my God.
That's a sick thought.
Yeah.
I don't think normal temperate drinkers do that. I just don't. Anyway, he explained all to me about what my problem was and I identified he drank somewhat like I did. And I learned a lot. He left me a big book. I read Bill's story and identified. And I stayed sober for 7 days. Now, in the front of that book, he wrote down where the meetings were in our little town. We had three of them at the time. Some were in about 2 weeks because I hadn't gone to one. I decided to race those because if I didn't look at them, they didn't exist because I didn't go to them. And I stayed sober 7 days. My wife asked me to go down to the liquor store. She drank, and she said, get me a bottle of wine. I went down to the liquor store and got her a bottle of wine, and they sell little minis there. And I got two little minis of whiskey without thinking about it and drank them on the way home, and off to the races. Off I went. Matter of fact, I went back to the liquor store that night, and off to the races. And that was in probably May. September came around, and nothing changed other than I was incredibly daily drinking, couldn't work, couldn't do anything reasonably well. My wife was angry all the time. And I was angrier. I was incredibly angry. I had seething rage, just seething rage. If you commented in about my behavior, I would just overreact and tell you all kinds of things that I thought might be true about you and your family. Anyway, there was a day, and it was no different than any other day. I just happened to go out into the desert, got lost, couldn't find my truck, it was 500 feet away, drank way too much, passed out, did all the things that I'd pretty much been doing all the way along. Later into the evening, I came up with this great tracking plan. I decided that my truck should be on a road, and if I got on the road and followed it, maybe I would find my truck. And it worked. I found my truck. I drove back in. I had planned really well on the way in how I was going to get out of the truck, my excuse of why I was 5 or 6 hours late, and I was going to walk in and go to bed and everything would be fine. And I got out of the truck, and a root of the tree that was parked next to my truck destroyed the entire plan because it tripped me. And I fell flat on my face, and my wife was standing at the back door looking out the window, and she just turned away, and she had that same look that the clerk did in Arizona, that look of disgust. And when I got in the house, she had bags packed. And this is a woman that does not do things lightly. There was clothes in those bags. And she was leaving. She was leaving. So I pulled out the last card I had. I'll go to one of them meetings if you don't leave till, I don't know, it was like Thursday, and meeting was the next day. And I said, I'll go to one of those meetings tomorrow night. If I don't go to the meeting, you can leave. She didn't leave. I went to the meeting. It was incredible. It was incredible. I'm one of the incredibly lucky people that walked into a meeting, my first meeting, and I got it. I didn't know what I didn't know. The guy came and told me a few things, but I didn't know. I didn't know you people existed. I didn't know you were my people. I walked into that meeting and there were bright and shiny eyes. And you looked at me and you smiled at me. And I wasn't something to smile at. I was yellow with jaundice. I could not hold a cup of coffee. I smelled really bad because the booze was just pouring out of me. And I was just a shaky little drunk. And you got me a cup of coffee, half, and you sat me down, and I distinctly remember, this happened the other day in Early Birds, in a different situation, and somebody put their arm around me. I was home. And I don't know why, because, you know, I didn't know you. I didn't know any of the people in that room, but I just absolutely knew that you were my people and this was the place for me to be. And this all happened right there at that moment. And then you said something that was the oddest thing ever. You said you wanted me to come back. Yeah, you asked me to come back, and nobody had asked me to come back for a long time. A long, long time. So you asked me to come back, so I did. And I started coming back, and you suggested that I not drink between meetings. It seemed reasonable. I started doing that. And it worked really well. It did. Now I was still restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, and I was still just, you know, and I don't know if you've been there, but I was there. And a gracious, wonderful lady saw me one night and she said, "You're kind of nervous." It was kind of like, yes, I am. And I says, "I can't stop thinking about drinking. And I don't want to drink, and I can't stop thinking about drinking. But I'm thinking about drinking all the time. That's all I'm doing is thinking about drinking." You know, and I said it pretty much in that kind of a tone. And she says, "Well, do you believe that I believe?" Now, I was bold and beautiful and full of myself. But I wasn't full of myself to tell this lady, "No, I think you're full of it." You know, there was enough in me, and I'd been beaten down enough that I says, "Yeah, okay, I'll let you have it, that if you want to believe, you know, I didn't say all of that, but I said, yes. She said, will you do something for me? I said, maybe. I'm beat. I'm down. I'm yellow. My liver's not working, and it's maybe. Okay? I don't want to drink, but it's still maybe. She says, go home tonight and ask that this obsession for drink to be removed. And I says, what am I asking? She says, don't worry about it. Just go home and ask. Okay. I think I can do that. Okay, I can do that. I did. Now, if she would have said, you got to get down on your knees and put your hands like this and do all that, I wouldn't have done it. I know me. I wouldn't have done it. And she made me. Maybe she knew me, too. Because she didn't ask that of me. She just asked me this. And I went home and did it. I went home and did it. And I said it sincerely. I know I did. Now, we, like I mentioned, we only had meetings about every 3 days there. I went about my business, and I went to the next meeting, and she came up to me, and she says, how's that thinking about drinking going? And you could have knocked me over with a feather, because I had not thought about drinking in those last 3 days. That obsession, that mental thought process that we have, when we got to have a drink, we got to have a drink, we got to have a drink, that was lifted root and branch. Gone. Absolutely friggin' gone. Now, I'm not telling you that I've never had a stupid thought and I see a nice cold beer, one that I've never had, you know, because they got all kinds of new beer now. And I have a feeling that it's pretty much what I want because it's got alcohol in it, you know. And I think, wouldn't that taste nice? And I'm just fooling myself because I never once had a beer because it tasted nice. I only had a beer because it had alcohol in it. Guaranteed. Guaranteed. That wasn't the way it was, you know. So, but by and large, I've never had a real serious thought since then. That was a long time ago. That was over 25 years. Now, that ain't the end of the story. Because if that's all you do, you're just going to be dry. There was a fellow in that meeting that had actually been hoovering around me. I kind of noticed that every time I went somewhere, he was there. If I was on that side of the room, he would be on that side of the room. If I was over there, and he wasn't following me, he was just there, okay? And we started talking, because I don't know whether you guys felt this when you first got here, but I felt as if I said anything, you would figure out what I was all about and ask me to leave. You really would, because if you really knew what I had done and knew what I was thinking, you would just not want to be part of, you know, off you go. Anyway, so this fellow, he kept coming around, and his name was Max, and we were as far apart in this compatibility as we might be. I was an archaeologist with a master's degree and been to school, and he was a sheep herder. He was a sheep herder. And we had nothing in common other than the solution to alcohol. And he said to me, well, we only have meetings a few times a week. What do you think about coming out to my house and we'll start looking at this book together? Okay. It's a long time between this meeting and that meeting, and I'm struggling in between. It seemed like a reasonable thing to do. And that trip out there the first time, he lived 3 miles out of town. The first time I was driving out there to his house, I turned around 3 times. Because I don't know what it was that he was going to do to me, but I was still full of fear. And I don't know what he was going to do, and I don't, you know. But then I think about drinking and, you know, or not wanting to drink and wanting to get better and all of this, you know, and they had what I wanted. I got to do what they're doing kind of thing because they're telling me that, you know. I don't know what I don't know, but now I know what I don't know. I know I want this. That's what I want. So I turn back around. I finally get out there, and a wonderful man. Absolutely wonderful man. Incredible man. And I was, like I said, I was educated. I could not read. I could not read an entire sentence and understand what it said. And he and I read the book together. And he explained to me, sentence by sentence, thought by thought, of what the book was about. And that's pretty much how we worked the steps. Thought by thought, because that's where I was. If you would have given me the book and said, go look on page in the 50s and make that little table and write down your resentments, it was beyond my capability. I could not have done that. I could not have done that. It was not possible for me to do that. He knew that. And we started that process of him working me through that. Something happened about that time, about 3 weeks into this process where I was getting to know Max, that literally changed my life. When I took that drink at 13, there was a euphoria that came with that drink, an absolute euphoria. I rarely have experienced that. What I'm going to explain to you, the day that this, I got close to it. Max's mother had died, and he had taken care of her for the last 4 or 5 years. And her place was down in Moab proper, and he lived out of town in a trailer. And they were going to liquidate his mother's house. And he still had his chickens down there. He had a chicken coop, and there was like 20 of them. And there was a get-together. It was a bunch of his sponsees, I being one of them, and then there were some other men in the program. And we all went to Max's house on a Saturday. And I got a trailer. It was a little flatbed car hauler, and we were going to move the chickens. Now, I didn't really know what this was all about, but I know how to move. You get a six-pack of beer, show up, and get it done before the beer's gone. That's what I know. So we get over to Max's house. They're all being really nice to me, and we did something really odd. We didn't get right after it. We sat on his back porch and drank coffee and had a little informal meeting. Just fellowship. And I was part of it. And they were all talking to me like I was one of them. So after we have some coffee, and there may have been something else, but we sat around and did that for a little bit. Three or four of us younger people in our 30s, because there was much older people there too, well, we went out, and the first task was to get the chickens in the coop so that you could board them up, and then we could move the coop with the chickens in it. So I wanted you to image this, that there's three or four guys in the coop, and we're shoo, shoo, shoo. And we're shooing chickens. And we got most of them in, and a couple ones didn't want to, so we ended up having to catch them and get them in. So we boarded this all up. I got to explain a little bit about this chicken coop. Max was a frugal man. He had never bought a board in his life. He found all these boards in the desert. Other people had discarded them because they were not of high value, and none of them matched. And this thing was incredibly rickety. Yeah, it was just, anyway, we got some logs and we rolled this thing up onto the trailer very carefully, and we got it on there, and the chickens are in there clucking, and we're doing all this. And I'm just one of, you know, and just, I'm not in charge of this. I'm just going along. I'm just part of this group. And I came up with a great idea with, well, let's chain it down. And one of the older fellows looked at me with this, you know, really compassionate thing, and, do you think it'd support a chain? Well, maybe it wouldn't. Okay, so anyway, we get in my truck, and this is when the moment happened. Max looks over, and he says, you might not want to go too fast. Well, that was an understatement. So we're plucking across town, 10 miles an hour. The chickens were just clucking like you weren't be wanted, and I'm sitting there with my sponsor moving his chickens. There was a moment, you know, happy, joyous, and free. I was joyous. I was part of. To this day, there's four or five men that I still get a hold of. If I mention chickens, they will get a smile on their face because it was memorable to them. I don't think it was as memorable as it was to me, because that was my first experience in the fellowship of doing something as a group. The first time that I ever felt part of. I had never been that part of anything in my 38 years that I lived. And I went on to tell that man absolutely every dirty, nasty thing that I did. Everything that I did. I told him all of it. And he listened to it, and he told me of comparable things that he had done. He told me the way he felt when he did those things. So I could start feeling the way that I felt when I did those things. That's what that man did for me. It was absolutely incredible, the bond that we had together. He ended up getting lung cancer, and I held that man's hand when he passed away. I can honestly tell you that I loved him in a way that I had never loved a human being. At that point, I'd been married to my wife for 13 years. I was more intimate with Max than I was my own wife. Because what I had with my wife was drunkenness. That's what I had with my wife. And it was selfish. That's what I had with my wife. Not today. Not today. I have a wonderful relationship with my wife. Because she's had, you know, 25 years of me trying to get better. And I've got some better. But that man was incredible. That man was incredible. He also did something that got me involved in service. I was at the little club, at not dissimilar than this, probably half the size. And I was angry and full of myself and very condescending and a little critical at times. I don't know if you guys were ever that way, but I was. And I was a trash can, and it was absolutely overflowing with paper. And I was standing next to it, and Max was next to me, and I asked Max, and this, whoever's supposed to dump this trash isn't doing a very good job. And quick as he was, he says, it's your job and you should do it now. Okay. Well, I quickly found out there's four trash cans in that building, and I dumped them all and I put liners in them. And then I would actually sit in the meeting and watch during the meeting to see if you put something in my trash can. And I would think during that meeting, I'll get that right after the meeting. I'll get that. I'll take care of that. And I was the trash man. And I did that for 4 or 5 months. Then they let me make coffee. Ooh, I got promoted. I was making coffee and dumping the trash both. Man, I'm dual. I got two hats on. The coffee thing was way beyond me. We had fairly good sized meetings of 40 gallon things, and you had to scoop like 13 of those scoops in. Well, I'd get there an hour early because it took 45 minutes to brew, and more than one night I would be scooping in and realize I didn't know how many was in there. I'd have to dump it all out and start over, because you can't make bad coffee in AA. Now, wait a minute. AA has bad coffee. Okay, you can't make it worse than it is. It was incredibly important for me to do that. Incredibly important for me to do that job. Now, did I get to go on and do other things? Absolutely. I eventually got to be the secretary of that group, and we had wonderful, contentious, heart-warming group consciences, and then we fought like little children. And we just exploded on each other every once in a while. I had two grown men with over 25 years of sobriety, each one of them with their shoe up, banging on a table, making their point, and I'm the chair going, calm down, guys. And we got through it. We got through all that. And I got to become the GSR. And then I got to be the DCM. And the silly people of Utah eventually elected me to be their delegate. And I got to go to New York City. Yes, I did. And that was an incredible experience. I think you get the impression that I love this fellowship, because it saved my life, but it also saves lots of other lives. I'm incredibly selfish, and I want my life saved. I want my life changed, and I want to become a different person than I was when I got here. I want that. But I also want all of you guys to get that same opportunity. And if this fellowship is functioning and doing well, we all have that opportunity. And that's what service does. It keeps the doors open. It keeps the books on the table. It gets the pamphlets that need to be printed. And I got to go back and be with 93 of fellow delegates and some trustees and some office staff and make decisions for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took that incredibly serious. Incredibly serious. I got to be back there. I got to go 3 times, actually. I went once for the conference, and then my committee, which was a cooperation with the professional community, decided to make me the chair of that community for the following year, which meant that I could go to the board meeting in January. And I got to go listen to the trustees make their decisions and have their committees. And we had a business by then, and my wife and I were running this business at different times in this. We usually had 13 to 14 to 20 employees. We were archaeologists doing oil and gas work, and it was very, very good. We really enjoyed the work we did. But in May, when the conference was, both of us couldn't leave. So my wife couldn't come to the conference like a lot of wives get to do. It didn't happen, but she could come in January. So me getting to be chair and getting to go in January meant that she got to go to New York. And we got to go to Ground Zero, you know, where the Twin Towers came down. Incredibly emotional place. We got to go all of the museums. We both enjoy museums tremendously. So she got to experience that. But the main thing that I got to do is I got to be in a group conscience of our fellowship, where we made decisions. Now, we make decisions in here a little different than, there's a lot of democratic groups out there that do things with Robert's rules and vote on things and make good decisions. I'm not saying there aren't, but ours is a little bit above all of that. I don't know if you guys are familiar how we do this. We come and we talk about things until some people actually pass away because we've talked about it for so long. We have a tendency to beat these things, just beat them and beat them. And then we finally, after months and months, we vote on something. And we have these things where we call substantial unanimity. You have to have 2/3 for it to pass, substantial unanimity. Well, before we get all that done and you're doing all that and you got the vote and you think you're done, and then you go, wait a minute, does somebody want to speak to the minority?
Yeah.
So whoever didn't win gets one last shot to come to the microphone and give us the thoughts of why what we just did wasn't the best idea. Now that's democratic. A little more than democratic, I think. But you know what? I've been in a room when the person speaking to the minority changed it. Because what happens is when you speak to the minority, they ask the people that voted in the majority, does anyone want to change their vote? If one person changes their vote, then we have a vote to reconsider and we vote. It only takes 50%, it's a simple majority to reconsider. It's open again, and then the whole thing can change. And when that happens, I was in a group that I was attending, it was a committee in Salt Lake. And this was a long time ago. You'll know when I expressed this. It's a long time ago because we were still smoking. And there was a came up that whether or not there was going to continue to be smoking. And the group voted in the majority that it would continue to be smoking. And we all voted and we went through the process and everything. And this one gal at the end rose to speak to the minority. And she says, I'm going to have to resign my position if the vote stands, because I'm pregnant and I can no longer be in the presence of smoke. We changed that vote and we didn't smoke, because that's what we do. That's the type of thing that the minority can speak to, and you immediately know that you've done something that needs to be changed. And that's what our fellowship does. That's what our fellowship does. Yeah, I work the steps, I work with sponsees. I got to do all those things. Back in New York, it was really special. One of the things that I've learned is that when I go places that I'm uncomfortable, it's best to take people that are more comfortable. So my sponsor had served as the delegate immediately before me, and I took him to New York with me when I went back there the first time. And we went early so that we could do some special things that I mentioned, you know, the Ground Zero and all that. Well, he brought his sponsor, who also happened to be a delegate. And the three of us, by then Gay was getting rather old, but the three of us were running around New York as if we were teenagers. We went to a Yankees game. I had never been to a professional baseball game. Gay had never been to a professional baseball game. We had $45 hot dogs. And they were yummy. Jeter was in front of my seat. He looked and was looking at all these children, and he asked one of them, is it your first game? I don't know what possessed me to say it. I said, it's my first game. And he threw me a baseball.
Wow.
And this little kid over there was crying.
Aww.
I gave him that ball.
Yeah.
And I look over, and my sponsor's got a tear in his eye. Because that's what we learn to do. That's what we learn to do. It's those kind of things. Sure, I'd love to have that on my mantle or wherever, desk or what, you know. I don't have a mantle. That was where I was thinking. But anyway, that's the things that happens. Since I've got here, some things have happened. Everything has changed. I no longer have work. I retired, you know, and that's all different. That's all different. And like I said, I grew up here. And when I grew up in Edmonds, we used to, the family used to fish at CQ. It's in my blood. The Salish Sea is part of me. There's nothing that I enjoy more than being on the water here. And in Utah, I don't know why I had a boat, but I had a boat. There's some lakes that you can take them on. But when I got here, a beautiful boat was 6 years old, and it had 7 hours on the engine.
Wow, nice.
Okay, that's boat abuse. You should not be allowed to do that to a boat. Anyway, I got here, and I started fishing out here, and I started catching, and I started learning, and I joined the club, and I met some people, and it just has been fantastic. Now, like I mentioned, my grandfather loved to fish. One of the things that he wanted to do was he wanted to fish at, actually it was Campbell River at the time. It's on the north end of Vancouver Island. And we never got to. We had that business and we got by. We had meals. I worked my way through college. We weren't broke. So there was no money for that. That was beyond the scope of what we could do. That was just not in the cards to go on a big fancy fishing trip that way. But he had always wanted to. So when I joined this club quite a while ago, a year and a half, they started talking about this trip that they take, and they take their own boats, and they go across the Coho Ferry over to Victoria, and they motor on up the island, and they launch at a place, some river, Gold River, and they run down these fjords. They call them inlets, but I've been to Norway and they're fjords. And it's gorgeous. There's no houses, there's no development, few fish farms, but other than that, it's just gorgeous. And Monty's with me, my sponsor, the one that went to New York with me, my best buddy ever. And the two of us, he's a couple years older, and we got tears in our eyes from the beauty and the thought of getting to do this, because I was taking this trip for my grandfather. My grandfather never got to take this trip, and I was taking it. And I was thinking about him the whole time. So we go ahead and we're running down this fjord. 45 miles is a long ways. And I'm with five or six other very, very skilled people that had been there years, numbers of times. I'm very safe. But I'm in this, we call it a trash line. There's a bunch of boats. We're putting along. And it's just kids having fun. Just kids having fun. And we get to it, and it's a floating lodge. And they feed you really well. And if the weather's not too bad, you get to go out in the ocean. And so Monty and I, we're just fishing our little hearts out. And we're catching, you know. We ended up bringing back 250, 300 pounds of fish. We did well. We did really well. But we had a moment out there that, again, is close to that first drink I ever had. It was joyous. What happened was, is we went out and caught our Chinook that day, and we caught, we could have two a day, and I think we had four fish, and it was early, and we went back and anchored out in the middle of the ocean and started fishing for halibut. Now, we get to shut the motor off, and it is just gorgeous. And there's about 40 whales around us.
Oh.
And these whales start singing. And it's just, you know, it's just incredible. And then I don't know whether you guys know what sunfish are. There's these great big, huge, round, just beautiful fish. I don't know, I don't even think they catch them. I don't know what they do with them. But they just kind of float around. And I don't know if you've ever seen a sunfish, but they kind of go like this. It was blowing kisses at me. And it was, we were together, because like I say, Monty and I are as close as we can be. But it was such a private moment that he's as far on the bow as he can be, and I'm back by the stern, and we ain't fishing no more. We's listening to the whales. And both of us finally kind of got saturated with this pure joy and came back and said, "That's a moment." And then the fish were on, and we caught some halibut. So that's what sobriety has done for me. Now, I just want you to think for a moment if you think there's any chance that a skinny, yellow, liver-extended, shaking individual that had to drink on a daily basis would ever be in the middle of the ocean listening to whales. I don't think so. Not without this. Not without this fellowship. Not without that Anne telling me to go home, asking me. She didn't tell me. She asked me to go home that night and ask for that compulsion. Max working through all those steps with me, taking the time when I couldn't do it, and he saw that I couldn't do it. He saw that I couldn't do it, and working through that. And then giving me all of these opportunities that you guys have given me. Is there any chance that I get to be there and do that? I don't think so. I don't think so, guys. I just don't. Now, is it all perfect? No. I recently had a fellow that I was trying to help. And he's one of us. He isn't convinced of that. He is not convinced that he's powerless over alcohol. That alcohol, he isn't convinced of that. And I learned another lesson, and you'd think that I should have learned this lesson a while ago. One of the things that I did in Moab when the business started taking off was there was no treatment in Moab. The nearest treatment was 2 hours away, and there was more treatment 4 hours away in another direction, and 4 hours away that way, and 6 hours this way. And I set up a nonprofit organization to give people the rides to treatment. And we had drivers, and there were times that they were in jail and we had to hire a sheriff to go with them because they wouldn't let them out unless they were accompanied by a sheriff. And we just facilitated people getting into detox. Well, the other day I got an opportunity to try to facilitate a person getting into detox. And I hauled him over, and I hauled him over, and I hauled him, and I hauled him. But I went too far. I started enabling this person. Lesson? The road to codependency is paved with good intentions. Where this is going is there's some people in my life now, some of them are sitting in this room, that can tell me when I'm doing that. Can tell me when I'm doing that. Because I don't see it. I'm just trying to get another drunk sober. I don't see that I'm enabling, that I crossed the line. One of my friends said, "I crossed the line. I couldn't have found the line if I turned around." You crossed that line a long time ago. He was exaggerating, but he loves me. One of the things that we get in this room, if you have people that love you, when you're on the phone, they can tell if you're having a good day or a bad day. You don't need to tell them, "Having a shitty day." Because I rarely will say that. I rarely will say that. Because even when I'm having a good day, it's way better than what it would have been if, you know, my bad days are better than all of those days. So even if I'm having a bad day, I usually don't tell anybody. But there's times that people hear it in my voice. You know, I lost my dad a year ago. That was sad. I mean, that was sad. But there was some joy right before that happened. 15 days before my dad passed away, I gave that man a 40-year chip. Getting goosebumps just thinking about that. The day that that man passed away, one of my sponsees from Utah was on a plane, called for me from the SeaTac airport and said, "Can you come get me? I need to spend some time with you." he needed to spend some time with me. My ass just fell off again. My dad just died. No, he did. He needed to come. He knew I needed him. And he came up here and he held my hand for a couple of days. Because I was a basket case. You know, it's not fun to lose somebody you love that much. It's not fun. We get through it. Never thought of drinking. Never thought of drinking. I just thought of all the times, and I thought how much I was going to miss him. I still do. Still do, a year later. All right, guys. I'm done.